Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Welcome back to Small Caps, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kerry Stevenson, and I'm pretty excited today to be joined once again by a legendary speculator and investor, also founder of Rule Investment Media, Mr. Rick Rule. Last time we spoke was in October. Many of you really appreciated his time. So, Rick, thanks so much for coming back and joining me on Small Caps today. Great to see you.
Kerry, I love talking to the audiences that you've assembled through you as the medium. You ask great questions. I'm delighted that you decided to have me back.
Well, thanks, Rick. Last time when we spoke, it was October of last year. There was no thought of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. There was no blood in the streets. In fact, it was all very much euphoric. But one of the things that you cautioned our listeners to was that they should hold cash because, in your opinion, there could be a liquidity squeeze coming up. So you said we are seldom prepared for change, but you felt that people should be looking to change. Fast forward to May this year, there's been a lot of change. Rick, what are you seeing at the moment in the markets? It's very wobbly and there's a lot of concern that I'm hearing.
I think the market had a lot of challenges. One, in October, I would suggest that most markets, including some resource markets, were getting close to priced for perfection. Perfection, of course, seldom occurs. But we also had two other circumstances. One, interest rates on a global basis, but particularly in the United States, rose, and rose fairly rapidly. Rising interest rates do a few bad things to equity markets. They increase the company, various companies' cost of capital, yep, which decreases margins. They also lower the capitalized value of distributions, dividends, relative to other savings products. And in certain economies, they can lower consumer demand. So we had really a trifecta around an increase in interest rates. And on top of that, just to, you know, throw another spanner into things, the world decided to have a war, a fairly localized war now, but a war that, among other things, pointed out real fragility in supply chains around the world. And I think that war in and of itself probably has caused people to be nervous. The result of all that is that what had been euphoria changed to caution. And I think the decline that we've seen in equities markets doesn't yet reflect a rout, but it certainly reflects the fact that the outlook that we see today is much less rosy than the outlook that we were seeing in October.
When you say it's much less rosy, I guess one of the areas that I wanted, you spoke about the war. Right now, here in Australia and globally, I believe, we are facing an energy crisis. That is unprecedented. And what I'd like is your views on how that might play out in various commodity markets.
Well, remembering back to the 1970s, it takes a while for the higher prices engendered by an energy price crisis to moderate demand and increase supply. And that will have to happen too. Particularly with regards to oil and gas, but with all energy sources. They are capital intensive and they're permitting intensive. Imagine now if somebody wanted to build a new refinery on the east coast of Australia.
We don't have any refineries left.
Yeah, so imagine the permitting requirement, never mind the construction time. It takes a very, very, very long time to have the high prices that we're currently experiencing now become reflected in a market. On top of that, the big thinkers in the world, the politicians, including your own, are anti-fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. The result of that is that despite the fact that operating margins in both the refining side of the oil and gas business and in the upstream E&P side, despite the fact that those margins are at almost historic levels, the oil and gas business on a global basis is underinvesting in new project and sustaining capital investments to the tune of about $1 billion a day.
A day.
The political climate, a day. The political climate is such that the oil companies are afraid that to the extent that they invest or want to invest, that they won't be able to permit. At the same time, large investors around the world look at the political winds around oil and gas, and they're asking the companies to decapitalize. They're asking companies to return capital to shareholders rather than invest in the business that's created the money. So the circumstance that we have in front of us is one where normal economics are further constrained by, if you will, sociology and politics. Energy policy is not set by supply and demand anymore. It's set by the big thinkers of the world, the Bidens, the the famous energy economist, Greta Thunberg, that's it, the noted Swedish energy economist, and people like that. And, you know, what could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong?
Having the political class establish energy policy. Now, it is true that we would get some respite from this, some fairly immediate respite from this, if the Russians and the Ukraine found a way to give each other an off-ramp. Part of the dramatic increase, as an example, in seaborne liquefied natural gas has to do with the fact that Russian gas is less available and less transactable to Europe. And the consequence of that is that seaborne shipments that used to go everywhere seem to be going to Germany. Two, in the uranium side of the business, there was an immediate spike in the uranium price, since settled off some, reflecting the fact that Russia controls about 40% of the world's enrichment and re-enrichment capacity, a business that Australia should think about getting in. Were we to have a circumstance where peace broke out, I think that you would find an immediate softening in energy prices, in ammonia prices, nitrogenous fertilizer prices, potash prices. I'm not smart enough to tell you if peace is at hand. It doesn't seem like it right now. But I think there would be a respite to the panic buying that you're seeing in numerous commodities. If we don't see peace, though, I think the fragility in the supply chain might become very pronounced. If you look, as an example, at the percentage of the market share that Russia and the Ukraine currently enjoy in the wheat market, in the near term, that can't be made up elsewhere. It just can't be made up elsewhere. And to the extent that the Russians are forced to divert more time and treasure nationally to defense or offense, depending on your point of view, they will be less able to invest the sustaining capital investments needed to maintain their own production of natural resources. The consequence of that is that if the war went on a year or a year and a half, what you would find at that point in time is if the Russians were allowed and were of a mind to resume shipments, they would be able to ship substantially less.
Which leads me to the fact that there are going to be some supply constraints. And we noticed that India recently banned the exporting of wheat. So there are going to be even more constraints, which brings me along to the inflation thematic, because that will have an impact on commodities globally, won't it?
One would think that it might. The nervousness that you have around this is that one possible offshoot of this war and of the instability surrounded by war and the lack of confidence around the war would be a global recession.
Yeah.
In other words, it might be that ill spirits move from financial markets to markets generally. And the consequence of that might be a global recession or a depression that all the big thinkers and all the liquidity in the world couldn't solve for a while. That would, of course, decrease commodity prices. Commodity investors are in a very interesting circumstance. If the world doesn't have a recession or depression, there will be, given the current levels of capital investment, widespread shortages in supply in the next 5 years. Widespread in copper, in oil, in natural gas, despite the Indonesians' best efforts, in nickel, across a broad range of industrial materials. On the other hand, if there is a demand shortfall, it could be that supplies are adequate to meet diminished demands. I'm no big economic thinker. I talk about economics because I have to, yeah, in terms of what I do around my own portfolio. But investors need to think about both sides of that equation.
How do you think about both sides of that equation when it is so uncertain? We don't know how long the war is going to go on. I mean, President Putin is looking increasingly like he's losing a little bit of touch there, but we don't know. We don't have a crystal ball. So in this time of volatility, what is Rick Rule doing to ensure that he protects and potentially grows his wealth?
Given that I don't know, what I try to do is invest and speculate in what I see as a range of probabilities. My belief is that the best resource companies in the world will weather any potential storm and prosper should there not be a storm. And I try to look at companies that have durable competitive advantages. In the case of juniors, as an example, I try to look for companies that have tier one deposits, deposits that will have a market almost irrespective of the state of commodity markets. In the case of bigger companies, I look for companies that control deposits that are in the best quartile worldwide in terms of return on capital in the world, and also in the lowest cost quartile worldwide. When I can, I look for companies that have reasonable track records with regards to overall corporate return on capital employed, which is to say companies that can reinvest cash flow during flush periods like this now to in fact grow their production base. That's a fairly rare group of companies. And by constraining my own investments to either investment grade companies that are best of breed or speculative explorers that are in their own context best of breed, I seem to be able to weather bear markets and prosper in bull markets. There would seem to be a different class of speculator and investor whose deployment methodology would seem to be got a hunch, bet a bunch. It's difficult to imagine a scenario where that group would do well.
What you're saying is that there's too many people out there that are what we call gambling because they don't actually do any research. They just hear that this is the next big thing. I guess you could almost say that to the crypto market, that people just are piling in without fully understanding what even cryptocurrency is. And it's the same with commodities.
Well, certainly the thing that kept me out of crypto is I have no particular interest in investing or speculating in a subject where I don't feel that I'm competent, where I don't have any competitive knowledge advantage. And crypto almost describes that for me. You know, when I look at certain circumstances out there, Carrie, the global oil and gas business would be one. Yes, the easy money has been made in the move from $20 US a barrel to whatever it is today. But the truth is that the major oil company, major producers worldwide, including, Woodside and Santos in Australia, are selling at price net asset value ratios that would suggest that the oil market was at 65 or 70. Mm-hmm. And would suggest, too, that the natural gas market was closer to $4 per million BTU than $8.5 or $9 US dollars per million BTU. Now, it isn't impossible to believe that those price levels could be violated on the downside in the event of a recession or a depression. But I think it's unlikely. And if you have a circumstance where there's an industry that is as determinedly out of favor as the oil and gas industry is, one that is as cheap as it is, one that generates as much free cash as it does, one that's polite enough to return a lot of that cash to its owners, which is to say the shareholders, and one where perversely the whole political class is making their business better by constraining new investment and maintaining higher prices for longer. I mean, it's odd to see Greta and Biden as the champions of the oil and gas business, but in some senses, that's what they are with existing production. I think that while there's no certainty in life, the probabilities around doing well, buying the best of the best oil and gas producers, and enjoying, by the way, very handsome dividend yields compared to other income levels that you could get, is a pretty good thing.
Yeah. Do you think that there is this move, I guess, politically, and we are, in my opinion, over-governed globally. So many so many politicians with their nose in the trough and are turning around and saying, we must go this way. There is that sort of move to the zero carbon emission world that they all want us to live in, which brings me quite nicely to one of your favorite topics, which is uranium. Now, the uranium market, although it did start to have a little bit of a move and started to have some momentum, it seems to have settled a little bit. I'd love your views on where you think, I mean, this is, we are in an energy crisis. Uranium is a great fuel source and it's zero carbon. What's your views on where the uranium market's headed?
I think uranium's a no-brainer. I've had the good fortune of being interviewed by you many times. And so there are points in time when I think that the uranium stocks are ahead of themselves, that the narrative has overrun the reality. And there are other points in time. I mean, the uranium investor is a manic depressive, it would seem. We're in a circumstance now where while the uranium price may have $2 or $3 downside US dollars per pound, it probably has $30 or $35 upside. And if I look at my downside, let's be generous and say my downside is $5 US dollars. And my upside is $30 or $35. That's a pretty good juxtaposition of risk to reward. Now, I monitor 75 public uranium companies in the world. Wow. And I can, at the right price, only buy 12 with a straight face. In other words, there's too many pretenders in the space. But I think if you focus on those companies, and if particular, in particular, if you focus on those companies in days when equity markets, tertiary equity markets, speculative equity markets are getting crushed, that it's a wonderful place to be as a speculator. Particularly wonderful with the spot price of uranium falling in the face of, as you say, attractive political winds around non-carbon generating baseload power and around geopolitics. Japan became the second largest consumer of uranium in the world as a direct aftermath of the Arab oil embargo in 1975, when the geopolitics of energy supply were painfully forced on Japan. The Japanese decided that they would go to a fuel that was energy dense enough that you could store enough to supply the whole country for 5 or 6 years. The only fuel that meets that description is uranium. The consequence of Fukushima and the opinion of the Japanese populace, well-founded, I believe, that their government and electric power industry had lied to them, was the shutdown of the nation's entire nuclear fleet. The twin good winds of the fact that Japan recognizes that she needs non-carbon generating power and the recognition that the global supply chain of all things energy is very fragile, as was demonstrated by Russia, seems to me to mean that the pace of Japanese restarts in uranium is very quick. Wow. I've been for years saying someday, 2024, 2025, 2026. I think it's 2022 now.
Wow. Okay.
And that's very important. When uranium commentators look at the price of uranium, they point towards new plant construction in China and other places. From the time those plants are conceived until the time that they're consuming uranium is frequently 12 to 15 years. The pace of Japanese restarts can occur in 3 or 4 months. on a net present value basis, increases in consumption that happened in 2022 are much more important than increases in consumption that happened in 2032. And so for that particular reason, I'm particularly attracted to the uranium space. A restart of the entire remaining unstarted Japanese fleet would add between 10 and 12 million pounds a year of consumption. But importantly too, I think it would remove almost all of the available supplies remaining in the spot market.
Which would put that supply demand and put a little bit of a fire under the price of uranium, which I think is sitting, what's it sitting at the moment, about 50 something?
Less, 47, 48.
47, 48.
Okay. It's important perhaps for your Australian audience, which I realize is a big part of your audience, to know that my former employer, Sprott, launched the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust and has in the last, 15 months probably, bought about 30 million pounds of uranium, substantially tightening up the spot market. But I actually think that the pace of Japanese restarts would be more important because that doesn't constitute ongoing supply. It gets used.
I'm curious as to why you said that you were thinking more 24, 25, 26, and you're saying 22 you think is the restart for Japan. Is the energy crisis so strong in Japan that they have no choice?
We monitor through consultants the Japanese press. Japan Inc., which is to say the government and big business, has always wanted to restart their nuclear fleet. But the Japanese public believe that they were lied to around the plant safety at Fukushima. And there has been widespread public opposition to restarting nuclear power plants. The Japanese press now expresses a very, very, very different opinion. Now there's a groundswell of public support in Japan for Japan, as an example, meeting their original Kyoto protocols. The only way they can do that is to return to nuclear power. Similarly, the interruption of seaborne liquefied natural gas to Japan, which was their substitute for nuclear, has been severely disrupted by the war, along with the fact that there's a growing realization that while Fukushima was a catastrophe, it was more a natural catastrophe than a plant failure.
Absolutely.
And the idea that the best chance that Japan has for reliable and economic energy is in fact nuclear power is important. Very recently too, across the South China Sea and the Sea of Japan, the Chinese government publicly stated that particulate pollution from electricity generation kills 500,000 Chinese a year. I think that realization is increasingly important to the Chinese, of course, who are building nuclear power plants, but building coal plants too, like mad, and the Japanese, who understand that they are rich enough to have a choice between the type of generation that they want to see. And I think for them, A, the choice is clear, but B, it would seem that popular sentiment has shifted from anti-nuclear to pro-nuclear. In other words, Japan Inc. will be allowed to do what it otherwise wanted to do.
Do you think that anti to pro is going to start to get out to the rest of the world as well? Because I think that's one of the key factors with the uranium industry, that the general public that don't fully understand this zero carbon emission, and actually with the technology around uranium today and these small modular reactors, that, you know, it is a great power source, but they have a lack of understanding. Do you think that's starting to change? Do you think sentiment is starting to go in favor of uranium?
If you give me the use of the word starting, starting. I think starting is correct. I think it has a long way to go. It's useful in my country, the United States, that opinion leaders, particularly in technology, who used to be a pretty green and liberal voting bloc, have switched very solidly in favor of nuclear power. The big energy opinion leading titans, be they venture capitalists, be they Elon Musk, be they Bill Gates, Peter Thiel, are increasingly saying the only chance we have to maintain our living standards is nuclear power. And my suspicion is that other people may not be willing to do the work in technology that Bill Gates has done. But I suggest that if they won't do the work in technology, what they may do is to assume that Mr. Gates has done better work as an example than President Biden might do.
Well, that's not hard. You mentioned Elon Musk, and obviously the Tesla share price has had a bit of a tumble, I think 50% off its highs. Uh-huh. But that area, that sort of electric vehicle and the electrification, if you like, of the energy space is still going to happen. So that critical minerals space. And Elon was talking about potentially buying supply, buying the mines, getting into lithium mining himself. But what's Rick Rall feel about those, that critical minerals sector?
I think the critical mineral sector is a great theme, not necessarily because Mr. Musk is going to go from, you know, a million cars sold to 1.3 million cars sold, but rather because of the electrification of humankind. Mm. Many of your listeners won't know, Carrie, but they should, that 1.2 billion people on Earth have no access to electricity. Another 2 billion people on Earth have access only to unaffordable or intermittent electricity. Mm. Mercifully for all of us, in the last 40 years, we've seen remarkable material gains among the poorest of the poor in the planet. And mercifully, too, those material gains continue. When poor people get more money, the things that they spend it on, the things that, that better their lives, are largely material.
Yeah.
And if 1.2 billion people on Earth get access to electricity, which is what I think happens over the next 20 years, it isn't merely the batteries, although the batteries will be important. It's the copper to get the electricity from where it's generated to their house. It's the copper that they use inside their house. It's the little gadgets that they buy that use electricity that makes their life so much better. Distributed power, which is to say small-scale generation, irrespective of how it takes place, a gas-fired generator, a solar plant, a little windmill, whatever, requires storage, which is to say batteries. So the whole theme of global electrification, particularly the uplifting of the poorest third of humanity, bodes extraordinarily well for all things electric, specialty metals, copper, nickel, that whole suite of materials.
And that, so therefore you see that the supply, the demand for those particular commodities will continue into the future, regardless of whether there's a pullback and a recession slash
depression. Yes, and Carrie, at current availability, shortages are inevitable. You don't need to go too far down the periodic table into various elements that your listeners can't pronounce. You can look up at the top at copper. Most copper mines that are producing the stuff that generates power now, I mean, they're my age. They're long of tooth. You know, Grasberg is 60 years old. Escondida is 40 years old. Bingham Canyon's 150 years old. Chuquicamata is 115 years old. We have underinvested as an industry in copper exploration, in production and development, and we've underinvested for 30 years. We can't turn the switch and get more copper. Exactly. One example would be the Resolution deposit in the United States, joint venture between BHP and Rio Tinto. Two companies who could afford to build it. This deposit was discovered 20 years ago. It's been in permitting 15 years,
wow,
likely in permitting for another 10. Then it'll take $6 or $7 billion.
Why 25 years?
Well,
are we going back to government again?
Don't tempt me, Carrie. I might answer. And it's difficult to do without using four letter words that aren't gold. Yes, I think that people make strange decisions and people elect elected officials who make strange decisions. My point wasn't to be political, but merely to say, even in the aftermath of a recession, if that's what occurs, that the supply shortages that we're going to see in materials like copper will be such that the industry is going to have a challenge meeting the demand that humankind places on it to merely uplift the lives of the bottom third of humanity. That isn't to say when Carrie switches from a Mercedes to a Tesla, or does whatever she does. From my point of view, that's merely the icing on the cake.
You talk about 1.2 billion people that have no access to electricity, and another, a further 2 billion that have intermittent access. That seems to me that there might be still a greater need for the world supply of coal. Now, I know that's another four-letter word that is a very dirty word that people don't like to talk about, but facts are facts. And here in Australia, energy is becoming very much a talking point as prices have risen almost 100% in 12 months, and it is becoming the talking point of Australia. What is happening with coal? Even though people don't like to talk about it, it is cheap baseload power. And as investors, again, people might not like to hear this, but at the end of the day, we need energy. What's Rick's view on the coal sector?
It might amuse your listeners to know that the largest year in history for coal demand was 2021. Mm. So much for a sunset fuel. It looks as though 2022, as a consequence of the war in Ukraine, will eclipse 2021. There's a whole bunch of people around the world, myself included, who would like to see a cleaner future. Absolutely. I'd like to see us pollute the air less. I'd like to see us pollute the water less. Most of those people, the people who believe like me, when they walk into a room and they hit the toggle switch, they want the lights to come on. There are countries in the world that are not as rich as the United States, that are not as rich as Australia. There are countries like China, countries like India, countries like Sri Lanka, countries like South Africa. Whether we like it or not, they're going to burn coal. They want the lights to go on. When the big thinkers in the West talk about carbon, they're talking about sharing the cost of carbon equally. But seemingly, they don't know how to spell equally. If you look at the carbon in the atmosphere today, something like 85% of it was generated by Western developed nations. Wow. The idea that those of us who were responsible for generating that carbon believe that the cost of future amelioration should be shared by poor people who didn't generate the carbon is disingenuous at best.
Absolutely.
It's important, too, when the big thinkers talk about national carbon exports. They talk about the United States with 350 million people, and they talk about the amount of carbon that we generate relative to China when China has 1.4 billion people. Mm. The equation begins to change when you do it per capita, as opposed to per nation state. So if we are going to achieve the 2050 goals with regards to carbon, there will have to be either quantum leaps in technology or various very serious declines in the living standards of places like Australia, Canada, the United States, and Germany. And I don't think either the ratepayers or the voters are willing to bear the pain. I think they're voting to share the pain. Right. And that's not on offer. It's just not on offer.
So what is the solution?
The solution is what you're seeing at Davos. A bunch of big thinkers fly 500 private jets, charter 1,200 limousines, drive up into the Alps, and tell us to drive less. There's no hope that we're going to meet the Kyoto 2050 goals without massive improvements in technology. What there is the typical political solution, which is to say that politicians make very grand statements, use the crisis as an excuse to raise taxes, and then don't do anything useful. Extend and pretend has a long history in Western politics.
And that's the challenge, isn't it, Rick? Because these politicians around the globe that are turning around and printing more of the funny money and throwing it out at voters to say, I'm looking after you, don't you worry about a thing, which brings me nicely to a little wrap up, if you could. We haven't talked about precious metals at all. And I know that you and I love chatting about precious metals. Precious metals, you would normally think in an environment like this, would have had a little bit of a strengthening. It seems to not be doing very much. It seems to be sitting quietly on the sidelines. What do you think is happening in precious metals in this ever-increasing, interesting environment we find ourselves in?
I have two comments there, Kerry. When people tell me gold hasn't moved, I ask them to consider their time frame.
That's true.
In the period 2019 to 2022, a scant 3 years, the gold price has moved in U.S. dollar terms from 1,200 to 1,800 or 1,900. In my background, that feels like a move. The fact that somebody hasn't experienced a move in 2 months is interesting, but not particularly relevant in terms of time frames that matter. But the second thing I think is much more important and maybe less churlish. In my first bull market, which was to say the bull market of the 1970s, inflation was on the horizon very early on, 1967, 1968, 1969, 1970. What happened is that consumers and taxpayers and voters around the world had lived through 20 very benign economic years. And so although inflation was incipient and they could see it, it hadn't bitten them.
Right.
And they didn't feel it. It was a topic of discussion, not a topic of fear. By 1971, when consumers, although they had gotten pay raises, got pay decreases after inflation, when the net present value, the spending value of their savings fell 4 years in a row, which is to say, when inflation caused their real living standards to decline, all of a sudden inflation was front and center. But it took investors and consumers 4 years to translate the existence of inflation into the fear of inflation. Fast forward to 2021, 2022. The signs of inflation are everywhere. The press talks about inflation, but nobody's been bit. We've lived now through 40 years of benign economic climate. 1982 to 2022. People's perception of the future being set by their experience in the immediate past, people haven't had to fear inflation for 40 years. And although they see it, they don't fear it yet. But Kerry, they're gonna. Inflation is going to bite people. Think about the experience of an Australian saver. He or she has been taught to be prudent. So much of their super is invested in debt securities, owning 3%. While the depreciation of the purchasing power of the Australian dollar is in excess of 8%.
Wow.
The first year, losing 4% of one's purchasing power, particularly where it's happening in their pension plan, which they don't get to spend today, is of little import. But over 3 or 4 years, the understanding comes that despite the fact that they've been consistent savers, they are 15 or so percent poorer than when they started the exercise, all of a sudden comes into focus.
Right.
Imagine too, Kerry, that you are one of the biggest investors in the world now. You're the pension man, you're the investment manager of a big pension fund. And for the last 40 years, your capital allocation has been roughly 60% equities, 40% debt. You're responsible for the well-being of your pensioners 15 years out or 20 years out. And you come to the realization that 40% of your portfolio, which is to say the debt portfolio, at current rates of inflation, guarantees that you can't meet your obligations.
Wow.
What do? You have to disintermediate. You have to change the amount of capital that you have involved in 40% of your portfolio. Now, I'm not saying that that whole 40% goes into gold. What I'm suggesting is that the disintermediation out of these massive global bond portfolios will involve some shifting of assets that guarantee you a loss to an asset class that has proven efficacious for several hundred years in guarding against inflation, that being precious metals.
So you feel that there will be, once inflation, as you say, bites and people understand it's not transitory, that there will be a shift into the understanding that precious metals actually keep their purchasing power. And at the moment, that is just not on anybody's radar at all.
I'm so confident of that, Carrie, that despite the fact that I own a lot of gold and silver, despite the fact, too, that my portfolio includes gold and silver companies, including Sprott. In other words, I'm over leveraged to gold. I'd like the gold price to stay lower for a little longer. I'd like to own more. If the price of something that you want to own more of goes up, a bad thing has happened. Mm. If the price of something that you want to own more of goes down, a good thing has happened. Yeah. And I think investors, first of all, need to visit their premise and see whether or not they agree with me. But if they agree with me, there's an easy way out of this dilemma, which is to take advantage of other people's misfortune and buy more precious metals.
What a wonderful way to for me to just wrap this up by saying I am so excited. In July this year, I'm going to be traveling once again, finally allowed to get on a plane, and I'm coming over to your Rural Investment Media Conference, which I believe is in, I hope it's in Boca Raton, Florida, because I certainly booked my flights. Tell our listeners a little bit about the conference and who will be there and why you're putting it on.
Well, Carrie, I'll be delighted to have you there.
I'm excited.
It's been a long time since we visited at a conference, either yours or mine.
Yeah.
I'm putting it on because we've put on this conference with 2 years off for COVID for 27 years. And my long-term customers said that they want a face-to-face conference. They don't want another virtual conference, as easy as that might be. Yeah. My exhibitors, too, have said they want to get together face-to-face with their stakeholders. And in my business, the customer's always right. So we're going to do a live conference. And if we do a live conference, we're going to do a good one. And this is going to be a good one. We have some of the best, I would suggest, big thinking people in the world, but not ones that you would see on CNBC or ABC.
Or Davos.
Places like, or Davos, certainly. People like Jim Rickards, Grant Williams, Dina DiMartino Booth, Naomi Prinz, Doug Casey, Bill Bonner. So we're going to have great big picture thinkers that put the macro in context, that give you things that, while you may agree with them or may not agree with them, will make you think about the way that the world is going and the way that that might impact your portfolio. Probably more importantly, in one sense, where the rubber meets the road for your own investments, we'll have some of the best investment analysts and gurus in the resource space saying, if you think that this scenario comes true, this is what you do about it. More importantly than that, for sure, is that we have the living legends. We have people in attendance who will be speaking to our attendees who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch. People really who are where the rubber meets the road. And they will tell you how their experiences building these companies made them better investors and the lessons that they could learn that will make you a better investor. On top of that, we have a hand-curated list of exhibitors. No public company can exhibit at this conference if they aren't owned in managed accounts or my own personal accounts that are managed by me. Sadly, that doesn't mean that every stock I own goes up, but it does mean that every exhibitor there has been personally vetted, that I know enough about the company and I'm comfortable enough about the company's prospects that I have risked my own capital in those companies. So the combination of an unusually good access to big picture thinkers, of unusually good access to analysts and gurus, of the only access that you probably could get at a conference like this to the living legends, the people who have built billion-dollar companies, in conjunction with a curated list of exhibitors. You know, at too many conferences carry the qualification for an exhibitor is a pulse and a check that cashes, usually in reverse order of importance. In my case, they have to be companies that I'm comfortable enough about that I've written them a check rather than them writing me a check, which is a very different test, as you know.
Yeah. And by the way, one day we'd love to get you back for the Australian Gold Conference. When you can, we'd love, because I think it was, goodness me, it's got to be 10 years since you were last year.
I would love to do it again, Carrie. I would absolutely to do it again.
As things open up, let's get you back. But how do they find out about your conference, which I believe is the 26th to the 29th of July?
We can send you a link to post on this interview if you like. That's probably the easiest thing.
Sure.
Let's do it. And people can link and decide for themselves whether or not they'd like to attend.
Okay.
That would probably be the easiest. It's July 26th through 29th in Boca Raton. And I think
a nice place to be. Look, Rick, let's wrap it up with this. Could you give our viewers three things that you think that they should be doing right now to protect, if not to grow, their wealth in these volatile and ever-changing times?
I absolutely can do that. The first thing is that the most important investment that you can make is in yourself. Mm-hmm. Study your portfolio. Think about your needs. Think about your fears. Think about your wants. And make decisions that are based on probabilities, understanding that there are no certainties. Too many investors follow that theorem that we said, got a hunch, bet a bunch. That's not good enough. Invest in yourself, invest in your education, think about your portfolio. Don't own more stocks than the time that you're willing to commit understanding and studying the stocks that you own.
Right.
That's the first thing. Pardon me. The second thing is don't underinvest and don't overinvest. I know that that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but despite the fact that your cash savings are costing you purchasing power, you must continue to hold some cash. Having the cash will give you both the courage and the tool to take advantage of volatility. But in a market where you see a really dramatic sell-off, Carrie, like the kind that preceded my first speaking engagement for you, where stocks fell off like a boulder off a bridge, it's important that you act. Too often in very trying times, investors do this: ready, aim, 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 aim. You have to fire.
Yeah.
When you have a situation where all of those around you are heading for the financial exits, stocks are as cheap as they're going to get. You have to know what you want to buy, and then you have to step in and buy them. If a stock has fallen, if a stock is selling for $10 and you think it's worth $15, and the stock falls from 10 to 5, the only thing that you can think of is twice as good. The idea that you take twice as long to make a decision when the outcome is twice as good is something that you have to battle against. But the third part of the offer is unique here, Carrie. For people who care about investing in natural resources, I'm going to give them an incentive to think. Anybody who cares about my opinion with regards to their own natural resource portfolio can, of course, come to my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Post all the natural resource stocks in your portfolio. Please, once again, no crypto. Please, no pot stocks. Please, no tech stocks. Just natural resources stuff, things that I can do. And I will personally rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. If I have a comment around a company that I think might be of value, I will comment on individual issues. In addition to that, people who are interested, now that I'm not a broker anymore, I can do this, in people who are accredited, who are interested in the private placements I'm participating in Australia or elsewhere, can mention in the comments section placements, and I will put you on a list to receive information about the private placements that I'm doing with my own money and why. Just the fact that I can get into a private placement doesn't necessarily mean that all of your listeners will begin to get into a private placement, but certainly having access to that information is valued by some, if for no other reasons than to understand the methodologies I use to deploy capital. So the first was to invest in yourself. The second was to have the courage to be brave when others are afraid. And the third is to access free information, which I'm offering up at ruleinvestmentmedia.com.
Rick Rawl, always one to give back to others and to help others become better investors. It's a pleasure to always speak to you. And as you say, volatile, inflation is here. But you know what, ladies and gentlemen, it is about educating yourself. Stop watching Netflix, start getting educated. Go to ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Take advantage of what Rick just offered you, which is the ability to get into his private placements that he's doing, but as well for him to be able to rank the resource stocks that you're currently looking at. That does include Australian stocks, I'm assuming, there, Rick?
Absolutely does. I've been overactive in Australia in the last year. So,
well, there you go. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can also follow Rick on Twitter, and we look forward. And if you want to, come across to Boca Raton in Florida at the end of July. We can now travel here out of Australia. We look forward to seeing you there, Rick, in person. Thanks so much for joining me on Small Caps today.
Always a pleasure, Carrie. Thank you for having me back. And I look forward to coming down to Australia at some point in time and speaking at your conferences.